My name is Judy Madison. I've written a book called I'm Worried About Your Drinking, which is subtitled The Feeling of Family and Friends Who Care. I was moved to write that book because my father's an alcoholic. And having lived through that for 35, 36 years, whatever it was when I wrote it, I had experienced the struggle and watched what it did to one family and a number of other people, and felt that there were many persons who didn't recognize what was going on soon enough and then didn't know how to deal with it. So the idea of the book and the way it was organized was to have the feelings of these people lined out and the different periods of time you go through as you're trying to figure out, am I living with an alcoholic? In our society, the word alcoholic has had a real negative connotation, and so we've sort of hated to admit that it exists, at least until recent times. And I'm discovering, living as I do in Minneapolis, that it's more acceptable, you might say, in Minneapolis than it is in many places. That is not to say that drinking to excess is acceptable, but the term alcoholism is better understood. In that area, there's a high concentration of treatment centers and a record of successful treatment. And this book also will reflect those kinds of concepts that come out of that background. Vernon Johnson, who wrote the foreword to it, is a man who started an institution called the Johnson Institute, which works with, in the beginning, worked with alcoholics. He himself is an alcoholic. And then began to work with the families in what we call intervention, which we'll discuss in a minute, and then began to see how the family contributes to the problem, and so now works with families to make them well too. And that word well is a clue to an important part of this concept, which is that alcoholism is a disease. So as we look at this today, that would be the most important thing maybe for us to get a hold of. If you don't already feel that way, that alcoholism is in fact a disease. Let's think about what it is if you have disease. Cancer, diabetes, shall we try those two? Just thinking offhand. What are some things that make that disease? If you have cancer and you also have a weight problem, what's the most important thing? Is it? Do you think so? Have I picked a wrong example? Cancer is the primary problem. You deal with that. Alcoholism is a disease because it is a primary disease. For example, we say oftentimes, well, they probably had a tough childhood. Or this person has so many problems feeling insecure, inferior. That may be true. Those may be some psychological problems. Weight, maybe we would talk about. Well, you know, he, she is overweight and they feel bad about that and they drink and so on and so forth. But the primary problem in alcoholism is the alcoholism, is the inability to choose not to drink. That's primary. So then it's a primary disease. It is progressive. It's a progressive disease. It goes from one stage to another, progressively getting worse. Diabetes and cancer, same kind. You see that same thing. It's progressive. It is chronic. What is a chronic disease? Always there. So an alcoholic is always an alcoholic. Some are drinking and some are not. And they will say, anyone who's been through treatment or through AA and has kind of made it into a new state, into what we call recovering alcoholic, that person will always say, I am now and always an alcoholic. It's chronic. When you begin to think of somebody as having a disease, heart disease, whatever it is, then you begin to treat them differently. What would you, in the old days, I know what my grandma would have said, about what is somebody who drinks too much? I mean, what's the real basic problem? What was the old thought on that? Can you recall?
Sin.
All right. And along with that sin, and along with that, kind of a weakness. Well, it's a character weakness. Poor fellow, just a little weak in that area. Now, if we said, how would we speak of someone who had heart disease? Is that sin? We talk about that as sin?
Some people anti-sick.
Oh, yes, that's true. I haven't thought in those terms. For most of us, though, we wouldn't think of it as sin. And would we think of having heart trouble as being a character weakness? As long as we can separate out the disease concept of alcoholism, it does help us treat people. If you met someone who had diabetes and you saw them go into some sort of an attack, shall we say, an insulin attack, what would you do? And if they were unable to do, you know, behaving in a way in which they were not controlling themselves at all, what would you do?
You'd have to give them something sweet.
All right. If you knew what you could do to make them help them get well. If you knew what was wrong. If you didn't know even that it was diabetes, what would you do? You'd get help. You'd go and even take the person to help if they were unable to get there. That would also be true with alcoholism, except that a lot of times we don't know what to do. We don't know when it changes from mild abuse to serious abuse sometimes, and we are somehow afraid to take the action of insisting that someone who is that sick get help. It's a very difficult thing to do, very difficult to insist. And a place like the Johnson Institute, or there are others listed in this book, can help you do that. It takes some training to be truthful. It takes some good help and support from outside people who can help you be non-judgmental and can give you confidence that you know what you're doing and help you be stronger than you really want to be, which is what I think you have to be. I will share with you some of the feelings that we go through if we have experienced alcoholism in persons around us. This is called confusion, and in a sense it wraps up the whole thing. I try anger, but he gives back anger, stinging, harsh, until I weep. So I try shame. He feels remorse and hangs his head until he has another drink. I try pleading, threats I cannot follow through on. He ignores my words, and I am shamed. I try drinking with him, and I'm degraded. I try silence. And when I'm most resentful, I try ridicule, and I choke on my bitter gall. I was convinced that somehow I would find a way to solve, to change his problem. But deep inside, I know that it is I who has begun to change. I live in fear, discouraged. I tangle my resolve, try to please until frustration tears my smile in shreds of pain. I'm desperate as I lose not only his companionship, but my concept of myself as well. Some of the new language of treatment is codependence. That we discover that when alcoholism has lived in a family for a long time, everybody becomes in some way affected and lives differently. As the child of an alcoholic, I grew up from a very small child taking care of all kinds of adults. You want to make sure everything goes just right so that the person won't drink. You don't want to cause any trouble, especially if the person is drinking, because then you might get in an awful lot of trouble yourself. You begin to shape your life around what is happening with this other person. And you become, especially if you're a child, you become you become very skillful at predicting, at attempting to look ahead and anticipate what's going to happen next. How is he going to be tonight? This is Friday. How is Dad going to be tonight? This is Tuesday after school. She usually is drinking Tuesdays. That kind of thing. So that you plan your life in anticipation. So I'm a person who's a first-class planner. I can organize and I can see ahead and I'm a futuring kind of person. Those are the good sides. And I can't stop doing it. That's the hard side. So I don't trust life very well because it kind of hit me in the back of the knees too often. So people are damaged in sort of more subtle ways. Then they become codependent. I am as dependent on what my father does as he was on the stuff he used. And then we have enablers. That's another one of the words. Enablers we usually think of as being the mates of these people, and that doesn't necessarily mean they only those persons. In fact, I think parents are sometimes tremendous enablers. What an enabler does is allow things to happen without any consequences. Covering up is one of the things. They all know. I try to cover up for you, telling them you've had a trying day, chuckling or laughing at you, trying to appear at ease, making light of awkward moments. Still, I'm sure they know you drink too much. My masquerades do not disguise your loss of control. You're the only one who doesn't seem to know. You run away from the reality of your drinking problem by drinking. I can't tell his boss, he might lose his job. A man can't get along without a job. And his friends, so embarrassing. I'd really rather stay at home. I try to compensate. The children miss their daddy, and sometimes when he drinks too much, it frightens them. Someday he'll change. I'll just believe in him till then. It sounds noble. It sounds caring. And it's destructive. Because all that time, the drinking person can run away from the drinking problem, if no other way than by drinking. No one is confronting. Some of the most difficult times in that kind of family are holiday times. And I think to a person, if you were to discuss that with families, they would just weep, or they would shake their heads in memory. Because we look so, and maybe unfairly, and anticipate so, those holiday occasions, and they can be so spoiled. I hate Christmas. All the billboards filled with cheer and gin and beer. Parties, never knowing how you'll be. Choking food at lavish tables. Watching you waver when you thank the hostess, arguing that I must drive, hoping you won't take the first one Christmas Eve. The process of becoming an alcoholic, if you will, is kind of insidious and gradual in many cases. And people have different tolerances, and you'll hear people talk about, wow, can he hold his liquor? And we make so much of these things. We joke so much about it. We don't have parties without it. We are so concentrated in the use of chemicals, and now it's certainly much more than alcohol these days. And we make this so much a part of our lives that as it begins to take over, we almost don't notice. But one of the things we can look for is a change in the pattern. Now, I will have alcohol from time to time, and I just almost always have the same amount. And it's almost always two, I don't know. Either I run out of thirst, or I start to feel something and see, I'm a person who probably doesn't like to feel a loss of control. Remember, I learned from my dad, you have to be in control of everything because you never know what's going to hit you. So if you notice somebody changing their pattern, that's significant. We went along so normally, one martini every day at 6 o'clock, relaxing before dinner. Then it changed. You wanted two. And then you needed three to feel relaxed and easy. One day I realized that we weren't talking. You were drinking silently. We were alone together. and I was chilled by the unknown and by an unexplained and aching sense of dread. If you feel it, you should be watching. That's one of the times when you know that you're moving in some direction. That's a marvelous time to talk about it. When you want to talk to somebody who is drinking too much, in your opinion, it's not particularly helpful to yell and carry on. Long ago I gave up shouting. I think you almost liked the shouting. You knew what to do with punishment. You felt sorry for yourself. But talking doesn't help either. Today I failed again because I couldn't say what I really felt. You didn't fight back at my words, so I softened. I forgot to remind you of the empty bottles in the garage or the way you fell outside the door. I didn't recall your sulking quiet or your angry outburst at the children. Because you seemed repentant, I stopped talking. I believed in willpower again. I believed your promises. I failed. I forgot. You have no power of will over this disease. Those last lines are important to understand. A person who has a real drinking problem wants to believe that they can quit. First of all, we'd all like to believe that, wouldn't we? I'd like to believe I could lose 5 pounds next week. I keep thinking about it, but it just doesn't get any farther. A person who is chemically dependent, the word dependent means just that, they can't get along without it in their own mind. They can't get along without it. Now, whether that's a physical need or a psychological need, it doesn't matter. They can't get along without it, and so their claims will not hold water. And so we have to be the rational people. We have to be the ones who say, I understand what you're saying. I know you believe that that's true. Here's why it's not true. Because you told me 8 weeks ago you would quit, and you quit for 7 days, but then you went back. You quit once for 3 weeks, but you went back. Because yesterday you hit Jimmy when you'd had too much. Because last Thursday morning when you woke up, you had a drink before 10. Whatever those lists of... I mean, make a list. That's what we have to do. When we confronted my dad, that's what we had to do, make a list. Because when you get in the situation, the people you love are so hard to confront. And it's part of the alcoholic pattern not to be able to do that. We lived in a family where people just didn't get mad at each other very much. And that's real typical in alcoholic families. They don't discuss their feelings very well. And the person who drinks too much is a person who generally cannot admit too many frailties, as we would say, or weaknesses, or difficult moments. And there's an unspoken understanding within the family that you don't talk about those things. See, one reason you don't talk about it is because the poor person, let's say it's a mother, poor mom, she'll feel so bad if we talk about this. She'll probably drink again. And you're caught in a vicious circle of not talking about what needs to be talked about. So we delay those confrontations, we put them off, and of course the problem gets increasingly worse. I tell myself I can't leave you. A family needs both parents, and I keep hoping I can help you change. Remember that line. I can't leave you. You'd threaten us. You'll hurt us. You'll self-destruct. You'll tell everyone it's not your fault, but ours, and they might believe you. I can't leave because I'm not sure I can survive alone. I can't leave because leaving seems to blame you, or it signifies that something's truly wrong, and I don't want to admit I failed. There are two portions here where this person is saying some key things. I keep hoping I can help you change. And I don't want to admit I've failed. It is typical in an alcoholic situation that other people are taking responsibilities for the actions of the person who drinks too much. I am not too sure why that's true or how it works, but it seems to be very common. and we get caught. So when someone dies from that, sometimes we blame ourselves for their decision. It's a very hard thing for some families. In families where there's been intervention, and you've confronted the person and attempted to have them go to treatment and it didn't work, works often, most often, but when it didn't work, sometimes we take responsibility that it didn't work. That isn't appropriate either. Do you blame yourself for your wife's heart disease? Mm-mm. You're just real glad you got her to the hospital in time to try to do something. The funny thing about alcoholism is how we twist it. Or I think maybe how the people who have the disease twist it. Again, not because they're nasty people, because they need the stuff. Why is it that we drink it? I would suppose most of us have a glass of wine or something from time to time. What is it that we are looking for when we take that? Anything particular? Oh, we don't know. It alters our mood. Somebody's educated. That's different than most, I think. A lot of people... A good taste, and I forgotten now what was over here.
Social acceptance.
Mm-hmm. It's there, and jeepers, everybody's having some.
Fear of rejection.
Sure. Going together, that fear of rejection.
No, fear of rejecting yourself.
Would you explain that for me farther?
Not facing up to reality. In your own emotional standing, not being able to face your own rejection.
Okay. So then this makes you feel differently about yourself.
You don't know yourself. You don't accept the fact and say, well, I'll drink and that's okay. That makes me, in a sense, feel better. But
yeah.
I don't really face any kind of responsibility.
I see. Okay. I understand what you're saying. Those of us who can use alcohol appropriately do it for a lot of those social and taste and acceptable kinds of reasons and for some mood altering. Now, whether you want to make a judgment on whether that mood altering is proper or not is up to you. When one cannot survive without altering your mood, when you need to drink instead of want to, that's the big difference. I can remember my girlfriend talking about the fact that she began to realize that she went to parties to drink. She didn't go to parties to be at a party and then she had a drink. She knew from the time she started putting her makeup on what she was going there for. It took her a while to catch on to that and realize that that was part of an alcoholic pattern. Sometimes it's our friend, and I kind of think it's sad that we can't deal with that with our friends, but it really is very much more awkward sometimes. And so we buy into the society's patterns. Kathy shouldn't drink so much, Roger either, but after all, we all have one or two too many now and then. Anyway, how could we say, what do you say to friends who drink too much? We'd hate to leave them out, and we surely can't expect the rest to sacrifice their friends, their fun, because two friends can't handle liquor like the others. Here, Kathy, let me help you to the car. Roger, have another. What is the alternative to that? Although, at least you've been honest.
Yeah.
With yourself?
Pardon?
With yourself.
If you ask someone else not to drink?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that would be not
no,
honest?
I'm not saying that's not. I just say, ask this plain question.
I don't understand.
You're honest with yourself. Is that what you're saying? By asking
yes.
the question.
Yeah,
you've been honest with them about how you feel about what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. I had a brother die of it. And,
It's very painful to talk about.
He didn't want to quit. He asked him, he told him, just leave me alone, I'm happy. Leave me alone.
Mm-hmm.
So you say your piece, and you didn't want it. Because that is a choice.
The question there is an honest one. Can they make the choice?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is. He did make the choice.
Now let me describe what happened to a friend of mine. And I think it's very important to realize that this will be different for all of us. We're going to encounter different situations. I've put my father into treatment and was unable to change him. And did a good intervention. But he had enough enablers to take care of him. He had enough people who were buying into his problem that he didn't have to quit for me. And went in and has continued. A friend of mine went down to Houston to visit her brother, who she knew was getting so sick from his alcoholism. And his wife quite honestly said, I can't do it, I can't say anything, and I'm not too sure what list of worries his wife had, maybe some of the ones we've listed in the book. She couldn't face confronting, didn't like conflict, and was afraid he'd leave, I suppose. So this sister came and lined up all the things in advance. She did an absolutely magnificent job for not having studied how to do it, I thought. She talked to his doctor. She had things lined up at a hospital prior to going in to talk to him. She told his children so that they knew what was happening. The only thing I would have changed was I would have encouraged her to have the children be there. The wife was unwilling to be there. She was in the house but not able to talk to the husband. And she went to her brother and said, I'm here because this is what we have to do. And he tried some of the usual techniques, you know, which are, I can do it myself, I really intended to do this, always very accommodating and pleasant. And she didn't accept it, she didn't listen to that. And then he tried being pathetic almost. Not that he planned it that way, but he cried and so on. But she also didn't go into too much caretaking. She said, it's your decision, I can't remember his name, I'll call him Vince. You go to the hospital with me, or I'll commit you to a different hospital. And he was between a rock and a hard place. And he went. He went. Because he needed that.
I don't understand how she could commit him if he was insane. How did she get him like that?
Well, now it may be different in different places. One could do that in Minnesota. Now, it couldn't be permanent. Understand, you could, but you could get a certain number of hours with a doctor's support where the person could begin to dry out, so to speak, and then you could persuade the person, if the person's sober, to go into treatment. And that would be the attempt. And states are different that way. And in the state of Minnesota, most hospitalizations are covered of this type.
And at that time, too, we had evaluations where, you know, it's not only the person, but the family, too, when they are, they'll go through. I've been working with high school kids who have, some of them, it's really sad when they see a 15-year-old kid who says, I've been in treatment for alcohol 8 times, you know. But it happens, and it's not just in Minnesota, they happen to have treatment centers for them. But I know that's one thing that they all had mentioned, that, you know, of course, the denial that goes with the evaluation. I mean, one girl specifically was 17. She said her father was committed for alcoholism, and when they did the evaluation, not only for him but for the family, she was evaluated as being an alcoholic, and she was. But she was very good at hiding one of the good things. And she came out of the evaluation, she acted very indignant to her mother. Do you know that they thought that I was an alcoholic too, and she just really covered up? She was in she was in and out of treatment and cured before she even told. She was in treatment for alcoholism as a sophomore in high school. She was just entering her senior year, and she just told her mother this summer.
I'm glad you did mention the age thing, because really teenage alcoholism is a real important problem. And it doesn't focus in downtown New York, in urban sprawl and all of that, in urban areas and all of that. It's all over, because you see, it's a part of our culture to use these things. And it's really, you know, a lot of kids, and you probably remember from your own days, it's kind of a big deal to finally get to the age where you can drink beer and go on a beer bust and all of that stuff that may appear harmless, but it can be so devastating, especially for kids who turn out do not have tolerance for it, but especially because of this peer thing.
This may be a tad long story, but I think it fits right in with what you say and the alcoholic complex and the family involvement. My wife has a friend that had this happen to her, and that the parents went out of town and left the son at home for the weekend. And that Friday night, the son decided to have a party without his folks' knowledge. He and some friends, about six others, got together and bought a keg, brought it in the house. And when the police were finally called Saturday night,
it was still Friday,
they had 200 kids that had gone through the house. They had they'd gone to the expense of buying plastic runners to lay out the house. He had taken all of the breakables out of the rooms throughout the house and put them away so that they would not be broken. He had done it all. When the police were called, the kids scattered, and the word was out for the town force, pick up anybody who's got mud on them. Any kid that you see with mud on them has attended that party, because they followed the tracks and went through a cornfield to get away from them. They caught about 90% of them. When the parents got home, they found that the son had had the house cleaned professionally and everything restored at his own expense. And the only thing missing was a watch, and that's the only thing that they knew that something had gone on. They confronted him on it and found out, and then the word came back through the police. This is talked about as a very common occurrence among the adults in that town. They admit we have a problem, but see how well he handled it? They had eight kegs at that party before it was broken up, and the son has been punished, quote unquote.
And I think we encourage it as adults.
We laugh about it.
Well, who is it Foster Brooks who comes out on the stage and does an absolutely, if I may say so, magnificent job of imitating a real
third
drunk.
Third or fourth stage drunk.
Yeah. But I can't watch it. I cannot watch that. It makes me so sad that we can laugh at it. And our youngsters are very vulnerable with it so available to them. And with our attitude.
June?
Is there? Oh, yes.
Yeah, I was just going to respond to the comment Keith made. I think that with regard to the gentleman having the right to make that decision about his drinking behavior, I think it's good just to clarify that a part of the disease is the inability to be rational about having the disease. And just to clarify that other question about commitment, the commitment papers actually say that this patient or this individual is in danger of harming himself or others due to inebriacy or mental illness. That's the way the commitment paper reads in the state of Minnesota. So that many families that I've seen sign that paper, it's with great pain, because their husband, their father, their child is saying, listen, it's my decision, I'm 70 years old, gonna die anyway, you don't have any right to do this for me. And yet, you know, there's a long course as families begin to grapple with that. But I think for many families there does come a point where they say, you are incapable of making that decision, we are going to commit you. Then they have the evaluation that you referred to, and there are short-term, long-term commitments for 2 to 4 weeks or longer. Some alcoholics will go through that and remain sober, others will not. But I think in terms of sort of the honesty to oneself and having made that effort to try to help this individual, that kind of commitment, you know, is worth that try. But that's just sort of quite how.
Yeah, and here again, it's always helpful when you live in the same state and you're right with the person, which was true in my case, for example. But again, we could not commit my father as long as his wife opposed that, because they would not break up the family, his home, and she was opposed.
My brother was committed several times, but where he was, he could find himself out somehow. He would be there a while, and he would find himself out, and then he would go right back in the same.
Same pattern. Painful.
That's that voluntary commitment statute allowing under those auspices. I'm here not as a permanently ill, which is a funny definition, but under a voluntary definition for help. And if I say I'm all right and somebody else agrees with me, and the counselors, if I can convince them that I am quote unquote cured, I can sign myself out.
Okay. It's interesting that voluntary commitments, we keep thinking that a person ought to want to go, and it doesn't work out that way usually. And the ones who are not volunteering to go, can be just as successful. The percentages are very good for those who are going in almost literally kicking and screaming. Because once you get the alcohol out of them and can deal with people on a rational basis, it can be very helpful. Let me share a couple more ideas. One of the things that happens to the family, and I did enjoy the fact that someone came up to me and said this is exactly what had happened to her, is that everybody else begins to think there's something wrong with them. And we can be as rational as can be and say, and have that happen. When I talk with you or plead, trying to help you understand how you're hurting us and yourself, you stare at me and act as if you think I'm crazy. Am I? Am I crazy? To think you're ill and in need of help? I doubt my own convictions when you look or speak like that. Am I crazy? And we do it. We begin to think it's us. It seems like such an accusation, calling anyone an alcoholic, especially when we're not certain. We have problems, yes, and alcohol is often part of our dilemma, but to say it, it's like a brand somehow, a shame perhaps, or worse, if we should say it, we might have to face the fact that it's true. We mustn't let him hurt himself. Deep inside, we know he's good, a kind man. Oh, and I think we find this to be so true. If we generalize about personality characteristics of an alcoholic when they're sober, he, she is a kind person, generous and smiling, prone to dream a bit, but good. He can't help himself. If we don't make excuses for him, he may have to face his choices. He may have to look at what he does and hate himself. Or worse, continue to destroy himself, or me. I'd rather bolster his despair, a little fib, encouragement, a dollar or a half-truth here or there. Someday, who knows, maybe he'll want to change. And of course, no one wants to change as long as they've got that kind of system going for them. We talk about tough love. That is sometimes the only thing you can do. You have to be so tough. You have to be so firm with someone like this. I know what you're saying. I know you mean well. I know you want to try, but you can't do it. It's hard to do. You told me you could do it. I believed in you again and then again, but you went on. All the schemes I used to try to make you change were worthless. You went on. I'm finished trying. You're the only person who can choose to change. You're the one who has to take an honest look at who you are and what you've done. I can believe in you if you will take responsibility for your own life. Die or live. The choice is yours. If you choose to live, I'll be beside you. I want to explain that a little bit, and that is to say that if you have the opportunity to help that person live by getting them into good treatment or counseling and moving in that direction, that's what we should be doing. And at that point, as my friend did with her brother, to be able to say, I still believe you should be here. I know it's hard. And now, see, he's very ill in the hospital, and she has second thoughts, you know, and all that guilt and stuff. She's saying, still, I think this is still right. You would have been worse if you'd stayed home. You might have been dead. And no matter what, I'll stand with you as long as you will try to do this. Then the person at least knows they have support. They haven't been judged as being a terrible, ugly person who's going to be rejected. And that would be a genuine fear on a person who's abusing alcohol, abusing anything.
May I say something?
Yes.
In Cameroon, where we were missionaries, there was a large Presbyterian mission in the south, and also a large French Reform mission. And of course, they don't drink water. It's wine that they have on their tables, you know, and so on. But the drinking problem amongst the Africans became so terrible that these missionaries decided, well, we're just going to leave off our drinking of wine. Because they use that as an excuse, these are drinking, well, why can't we? So that's kind of a radical thing to do, but when I read Paul about, you know, causing my brother to stumble, for myself, I can't speak for you, but for myself, I'm a pastor too, but even if I wasn't, if I'd be drinking this and others be encouraged to drink a little bit at a time, in, of course, not much, just drink, and then gradually get into this terrible condition, it seems to me something radical has to be done amongst us Christians.
And I think that is a valid point. That is not, you're not being judgmental. You're just saying that if I am in some way by my behavior causing someone else, then that is for you a very viable reason not to drink, it seemed to me. In the back?
Are you saying one of the main reasons for trying to help these people is the damage they're doing to themselves?
Yeah, I guess I would say.
I mean, people do a lot of things that damage themselves. I mean, they overeat, they overwork. You know, there's a lot of things you can put in this category.
Would we say anything to someone who is overeating and overworking?
But we probably wouldn't put them in a hospital. Commitment.
Would there be a different level of them in the intensity of what's happening with the overeating and overworking? Are those as dangerous to the person's health?
I just think there's other reasons besides the damage they can do themselves is the damage they can do to society in automobiles and hurting people who work and this sort of thing.
Right.
It's not just yourself.
Okay. Yes.
But it's what you can do to somebody else.
Both and. Here.
First.
I just like to line up a little bit with Pastor Sandy said too. I think there is a whole society of people that don't drink. And I know in my own circle of friends, I can't think of a single one who drink. And we get together and we have really good times. So I think, you know, it isn't necessary.
No, it isn't. There are alternatives. And, you know, we did skip away from that. It is certainly possible to always serve something else, punch or something else.
You raised a question there of why people are afraid to admit to the state of being an alcoholic. And one of it is an outside influence in the fact that, let's say you take the case of a father who is involved in that and wants to make the decision to, and this is not an excuse, but a fact of life, that if he does admit to it, he's going to have to go to his employer to ask for time off to be committed or to join a treatment program. And part of the program is to admit to your employer that there is this situation, even though the employer may know it. A lot of employers nowadays will almost relieve you of your job because of the damage that can be done. And that even though it's not acceptable, but it's done, they'll get you out of the job, and then the next job you go to, that stigma will follow you, and it will be hard to find a job. That type of training and change in society has to go along with a individual effort, or nothing will. You're placing a person in a position of saying, I'm going to commit family suicide. And trying to say, I want to make the decision, but my responsibilities are this, right? And I'm still existing, I can provide some support. But if I do go to this program, then I can't do it. Now, this is changing, I'll admit. There's a lot of people. The federal government's one has a lot of support in this area, but there's a lot of private industry that is very subtly not abiding by those guidelines. They upfront advertise, we will support it, but in reality, it's not true.
Yeah, and I live in an area where that isn't true, you know, where a majority of it's kind of enlightened, mm-hmm. you know, where even the Vikings pick up their quarterback and send him out to California to take care of him and get him back and make big publicity out of that because it's sort of an enlightened area
mm-hmm.
in that respect.
But we all don't live in that area.
No. However,
you can come from
Yeah, for sure. And a place like the Johnson Institute can help you with the intervention and help you work with the employer so the employer comes along. You know, those things can be done together. I'm not pushing the Johnson Institute, by the way.
Jim, one thing you mentioned that you couldn't get, I get your mother or, you know, the father's wife to go along with getting him committed. Sometimes I've had people with diseases of alcohol affect my life in various ways, and then working with kids who live with it every day, I've gotten a lot of feedback on it. There are a lot of people, I think I read one of the poems in here, I can't remember which one it was, that kind of touches on sometimes this proof that the relationship will break up. I some people, whether they admit it, I don't think they really like it, but they're used to that feeling needed. Hey, if you're alcoholic and you're dependent on me, I have worth and I have value. I mean, that's kind of a screwed up system, but it's a reality. And that's why a lot of families that a husband or wife has gone through treatment and faced up to it, all of a sudden there's divorce because, hey, if you're my husband and you're alcoholic and you're, you know, I've spent my whole life, and, you know, with some of the stuff you did as daughter, and all of a sudden that's not there anymore. Hey, I'm not needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that means I have to change. Something about change is painful. It means I have to change too.
There is one in here about that.
I read it. You
got a comment over there?
Yeah.
Sure. I was just going to mention that I just sat through a session. I work at the Boeing Company, and I can, you know, say for that large company that it is alcoholism is treated as a sickness there. There's absolutely no stigma. But again, that's a large company, and they're going to definitely have a good program that can afford it. I'm sure a lot of small companies it cannot be that way. It is not that way. It can.
And of course, excuse me for interrupting. Realistically, they can't afford not to, because the money that's lost in keeping an employee who's doing such, you know, who has poor performance is much greater, but people aren't aware of that yet. We need to wrap up, and I'm happy to stay and chat a bit, but let me just share with you some of those basic facts about alcoholism first, and then if we want to talk some more, we can. First, alcoholism is a disease. Alcoholics cannot choose not to drink. They feel that they must drink, and they construct their lives to achieve that end. Alcoholism is not curable. It's possible to arrest the disease and to treat it, but unless the person ceases drinking and receives treatment, the disease gets progressively worse and is eventually terminal. Alcoholism is chronic. Everyone who is close to the chemically dependent person is affected by the disease. Often friends and loved ones develop patterns of coping with the disease which are not helpful in solving the problem. Four, and I would suppose this has changed. 10 million Americans are alcoholics. The HEW considers alcoholism to be our number one health problem. Five, alcoholics deny that drinking causes their problems. They tend to project their difficulties onto others. It's my boss, it's my job, it's my wife, it's my kids, it's on. Six, judging, blaming, pleading, and scolding are ineffective in dealing with a chemically dependent person. Finally, there's hope. If someone who is important to the dependent person will intervene in a non-judgmental way, confronting the dependent with the facts of their dilemma, it's possible for the dependent to seek and receive help. You can learn about intervention. And there are groups that you, if you are interested in finding out about them, certainly AA is everywhere across the country. You can find out there. But there are other groups listed here if you are interested in where you might learn about intervention.